Good morning. Good morning. TGIDF.
TGIDF.
Oh, Chris, you got it right. Yes, thank goodness.
Goodness, it takes me a long time, but
Yes.
when I learn it, I'm fast.
All right. Well, thank goodness it's Divorce Friday.
And not because it's divorce, but because we get to teach people about divorce, right?
That's right. That's right. We are the podcast that answers your financial questions about divorce. And this episode is special because it is just you and I, Chris, and we are summarizing our previous nine episodes that we did about alimony. We started this process, this alimony series back in March, and we have gone through the last couple of months, and we've had some amazing guests with us, family law attorneys who are experts in the area of alimony
And one
because
accountant.
that's right. Alimony is a legal issue, but it does have huge financial ramifications. So even though, we always say, well, we can never, as financial people, we can't advise you what to do because that's a legal issue. But what we can say is here are what the numbers look like, and here are your options when it comes to alimony. And so that's kind of what we discussed over these last nine episodes, are all the different things to think about when we're trying to understand whether or not alimony is going to be, if your case is going to be an alimony case.
That's really well said. I think it bears to repeat a lot, right? So I moved to share something I did yesterday when I was talking to someone about working on divorce cases from a financial perspective. And so you could see a little bit of the skepticism from the person. And I was telling him, so I don't encourage people to divorce. I don't make them divorce. I only help people who have to divorce for some reason or another. That's all we do, right? And we do that by helping them with the financial issues. We, as financial people, are the only people in the divorce team who look beyond the divorce date. The job of the lawyer or the mediator is to bring you to the finish line, which is the divorce date, the date that you show up in court with your future ex and have your separation agreement blessed by the judge. And maybe a little bit after that to tie loose ends, right? But we're the only people, financial people are the only people who look beyond it and who consider what's happening before the divorce in the light of what happens afterwards in order to make people financially successful after the divorce, right? And I think it bears repeating because somehow the message gets lost.
Yeah, no, it's you want to understand the impact, the future impacts that these types of decisions are going to have, the decisions you make during the divorce process. You want to know, how is this going to impact my future? And so
Exactly.
that's exactly what you're saying, Chris, is that we help you see what that future impact is going to be. So when we run different scenarios illustrating alimony, you can see what your quote unquote life is going to look like, both those who receive the alimony and those who pay alimony. It's like, well, the question is, well, okay, if I need to pay this, how am I going to pay for everything else? Well, let's look at that. Let's look at your expenses and let's see how you're going to pay for everything else. So that's where these analysis come into play.
And I think it goes beyond alimony, really, because alimony is only one piece, and it's taking us 10 episodes to dig through alimony issues. There are other issues, right? We've talked about child support last fall, and we've talked about issues of assets and the home and so on and so forth, right? And one of the things that we do is that we advise people on what happens, how to lean an agreement one way or the other in order to better benefit you.
Right. Yeah. So speaking about digging, I always think of digging as archaeologically, that and going back in time. But Chris, did you know that alimony dates back to 1700 BC?
I've learned that. I've learned that. So I don't know that, I don't remember that we've had an example of 1700 BC, but I remember in our first alimony episode, Fern Froland, who was our guest on that episode, mentioning that Julius Caesar had an alimony case.
Yes, isn't that crazy?
And I think we were talking before about that, and it is actually well discussed in Roman history about how that happened, and it's well discussed that, or not well discussed, but it is certainly discussed that Julius Caesar's ex-wife was getting some form of support. Right. And I think Fern was talking about the origins of the word, and it comes from a Latin word. So,
yeah,
as in fact, so many of our legal terminology comes from Latin words also. Right.
Right. So, you know, when knowing that alimony dates back that long should help you see that this is not something that was created in the modern times to hurt people. You know, it was built, it came about because of a need, right? And the other thing that I loved what Fern said is that she said, you know, marriage is a contract.
Right.
It's an implied contract that states the parties will take care of each other, both emotionally and financially, forever. That is the contract of marriage. And
yeah, it's in the vows that people say, right?
Correct.
For better or for worse, until death do you part.
Exactly,
right?
So exactly.
A divorce is really, from that perspective, from a legal perspective, is really a breach of a contract.
Yeah, it's a way to break that contract. So, you know, but as you know, the parties become intertwined and interdependent. And so separating those lives trying to maintain a similar lifestyle going forward is very difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why over time we've developed all these rules and guidelines and everything to try to make something that's been around forever, try to make it more fair and equitable.
And I think it's really bears repeating, right, is that marriage is a contract. In fact, in some cultures, it still is a contract, formally a contract. And today in our society, it isn't formally a contract, but it has the elements of contracts, right? Is that you promise, you know, to remain together till death do you part. And I think people say that at marriage ceremonies, right? And it may be helpful, I think, for people who are divorcing and are considering alimony, that to consider that alimony is part of what is needed to breach the contract.
Right.
What happens before a divorce is that there are a lot of implied planning that happens. There is an implied planning that mom will stay at home to raise the kids. Usually, not always. I mean, there is an increasing number of dads who stay at home to raise the kids. And when the divorce happens, that means that the person who stayed at home did not have the opportunity to build a career in the same way as the one who was the breadwinner. And therefore, there is a problem. Right. And that's what alimony is trying to address, is that there is a problem for the person who was staying at home, right, to be able to be self-sufficient. And that's what alimony is doing for that person. It is helping that person be self-sufficient.
Right.
And on the other side, it is helping the payor of the alimony get out of a situation that they don't want to be in anymore, right, without being, you know, with keeping a minimum, if you will, of a compassion for the future ex.
Right. I mean, it just wouldn't be fair to send the one person, you know, off on their merry way without any means of support.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, a lot more moms are working these days, and wives and women. So they're making their own income. But like you said, if they did stay home for any portion of time, like myself, the ability to get back into the job market to at an income level that where you can support yourself is not easy. And so that's why alimony also has changed over time, you know, to address the needs of the family and the changing times, because women are more women are working. But I see in my practice, and I know you do too, a lot of the older baby boomers who were never they never worked. And so, you know, now they're in their 60s and 70s. You know, there's no way that they can support themselves without some kind of support.
Right. I think it should be noted also that you don't have to go to the 60s and 70s. I mean, even people say in their 50s are being told that, well, they should go get a job. It's really not that easy when you're in your 50s and you haven't worked for 10, 20, or 30 years to, quote, go get a job that will pay anything.
I mean, when I, after my divorce, I was out of the job market for over 18 years, and I did find a job, but I was making less than babysitters were getting paid at the time.
I remember that.
And, you know, I was upset. I'm like, wait a minute, I'm a college graduate. You know, this is not fair. And,
And it isn't, but that's how it is, unfortunately. I mean, you can't force an employer to pay you more than they're willing to pay you, right?
this is true. So, you know, then we come into what we've kind of touched on, which is need. And in our second episode, our title was What Makes a Case an Alimony Case? And so I think what we talked about is that when someone has a need and someone has an ability to pay, then we have to see whether or not alimony is in order for this particular case.
Right. And the two words that you two actually more than two words, the two expressions that you brought about here are really important, right? They are fundamental. So we were talking with Andrea Wells in that episode, who is with Turco Legal in Newburyport, and that the fundamental of alimony is that it is based on the need of the recipient, and we've addressed that the recipient might have a need and the ability to pay or the payor. And so it's based on those two things. And there's a lot of time, what happens is that we tend to default to formulas because there are formulas involved. But fundamentally, it is about need and ability to pay.
In fact, in our statute, that is what it says, is that alimony is if for someone in need of support. That's the first thing that the statute talks about, is the person's need. And then it goes into the formula. So I know there's been lately a lot of digging into that, though, that the fact that need comes first in that statute, and that the formula is second.
Right. The formula, though, is where people tend to default. But for people out there who have to look at divorce, do consider that need is supposed to come first.
And then, and I think the reason why the default goes to the formula is because how do you define need? So
And
that
because formulas are easy, right?
formulas are easy, of course. You just run the numbers. But then you someone say, well, that's not, you don't need all that. You know? So that's where we look at need. But then again, need is very subjective. And it depends on the lifestyle that you lived. And also what's interesting is that it's not the lifestyle you lived maybe 2 years ago, which might have been higher than the lifestyle now. It's the lifestyle at the end of the marriage that they're equating that need to. And so that can be really different because if, let's say, you've experienced some problems, you know, usually a lot of times financial issues are a cause of a breakup of a marriage. So if something had gone on in the last couple of years and your life, you had to adjust your lifestyle downward, and now your need is being based on that downward adjusted lifestyle and not the lifestyle you had during the marriage, that becomes an area of contention.
Right. It's difficult, right? The reality is that that we also address then is that regardless of need and ability to pay, the what happens in a divorce is that there are more expenses and there are fewer resources. Right. And so there's always a conflict, which leads to people questioning what you mentioned earlier. So do you need all of that, right? And they are obviously good questions to ask, right? But the conflict happens because there are usually fewer resources than would be helpful.
Yeah, no, I mean, we all know that saying that, you know, if you were, you had one, let's just say one source of income for one household, but now you're going to have that same income for two households. So obviously something has to give.
Right. And something gives.
And something does. That's a typically a drop in lifestyle, a reduction in the type of income that you have available to you to live on your daily life. Mm-hmm. So that is where it becomes difficult. But I think what we were saying in that episode too is that you need to educate yourself so that you can manage your expectations. You know, even though you want alimony, it's on a case by case basis. Your case might not warrant an alimony. It also depends if there are children, and we've talked about that too. You know, so I think it's just being educated and understanding the possible outcomes can really save you time and money and help keep your emotions in check as you move forward through the process.
Right. So. When we went to the next episode with Justin Kelsey, who is who owns his law firm Skylark Law in Southboro, we addressed how child support might interact with alimony, because what happens a lot of the time is that people who divorce also have children, and therefore child support becomes a factor. And we addressed child support in our previous a series in the fall, if you want to go have a look at it, right? And but there were a couple of things that were worth mentioning, right? I think one of the key items is that the child support guidelines that are issued by the court change every 4 years. And that in the last change, which happened in October of last year, we've had some really different ways of addressing some of these issues. Right. So do you want to hit at one of them?
Yeah. So the biggest thing is that they increased the amount of available income, like the threshold that they kind of used to say, we're going to calculate child support up to this amount of income. So prior to the 2021 child support guidelines, the threshold was a combined joint gross income amount of $250,000. And that hadn't been updated in many, many years. I forget now how many years it was. So the new guidelines increased that benchmark up to $400,000, joint combined income of $400,000. And so immediately people said, oh no, what does this mean? Does this mean that now if parties are making up to $400,000, it can only be child support and now alimony can no longer be awarded? So yeah. That was probably the biggest thing, I think, that came about.
Yeah, I think it's worth clarifying for people out there what it means, right? Is currently, the first $400,000 of joint income are considered for child support, right? And what that means is that these first $400,000 of income are not also considered for alimonies, for child support. And in general, it would be the amount that is in excess of $400,000 that would be considered for alimony. One of the key things that everyone realized right off the bat is that most people don't make $400,000 or more, mm-hmm. right? And so therefore, one of the items that the child support guidelines points to formally is the possibility of doing calculating alimony first, right? And so you would have alimony that's going from the higher earner to the lower earner, and then child support calculated then on the basis of the new income from that lower earner, which is alimony, And the new income from the higher earner, which is their income less the less the alimony. Right. And so the interesting thing about that is that it allows the a calculation of two payments of alimony and child support, even though a couple's income may be below $400,000.
Right. Yep. And it's important to mention too that when the alimony task force was put together, to and also the child support task force, which our guest Fern Frohlin was a member of both, that she said it was never their intention that the recipient should get sloppy seconds, meaning that always calculate alimony, child support first, and then whatever is left over might be for alimony. Well, they said that was never the intent, that the leftovers were never meant to be alimony. And so it was clarified in the new guidelines that says, no, you know, when there is a need, we can look at calculating alimony first and then child support, or child support first, then alimony, or it's called unallocated support, and see how it works and see what best works for the family and their situation and what provides the most income after tax on a combined basis to help afford these households and the children.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, one of the things that the child support guidelines of last year did is that they complicated the calculations a little bit, but that's okay. It gives us more avenues to find a solution that is fair for both parties.
Right. And that's why you and I, that's why we are here.
So that we
can help those calculations. But one thing before we move on to the next one, when I was going through my divorce, one of the things that people used to say is that getting alimony in Massachusetts was like winning the lottery. And the reason why is because we didn't have the alimony law that we now have, the Reform Act, which is actually not new anymore, Chris. It's over 10 years old, but it always is referred to the new alimony law. Because before that, there were no durational limits on alimony. And so, and sometimes people did think that getting alimony was like winning the lottery, but we know that that's not the case anymore.
No, it definitely isn't, right? I mean, there are limits, so therefore it will not be forever. And therefore, it really increases the need for both parties, actually, but especially for the recipient of alimony, to think in terms of the consequences in the long term, right? And alimony certainly helps in the short term, there's no doubt, for the duration of the payments. But there comes a time when the payments will stop. Right. And a person who is receiving the alimony needs to plan accordingly. And that's actually one of the places where you and I come in the divorce process, because we're able to help clients plan for that.
Right.
It's also a challenge for the payor of alimony, because obviously their income is being curtailed so long as they have to pay it. And therefore, they are potentially not able to do things that they would like to do, such as plan for the future and whatnot. And that, too, needs to be considered.
Yeah, I think we addressed this in episode 4.
Yes.
When you and I kind of went through a summary of the financial impacts of alimony from our perspective as a CDFA, and that's exactly what we addressed. You said we look at the future. We're the only professional on the team that actually does that, and it's true, because what we do is we help you understand where you are now in terms of finances. We help you see where you're going to be the day after divorce. But then we also help you see where you might be 2, 5, or 10 years from now. So we do project into the future, because that informs you. And hopefully that information will help you make a better decision during the process. Because, you know, making an informed decision is really important. I would not want to go through the process making decisions when I have no clue what the outcome is going to, what the, you know, what, is there a benefit to me or is it a detriment to me?
I think it bears repeating, right? Is that again, is that the roles of the lawyers and the mediators is to bring the couple to divorce, right? That is their goal, to get them divorced because the couple wants to, not because anyone else right. wants to. Yeah. Our goal is to make sure that our clients are financially successful after the divorce. Right. There is a meme in our line of work where people are afraid of becoming bag ladies, right, and of ending up living under a bridge and things like that. And so our goal is to make sure that our clients don't.
Right. Right. Well, I think in one of our very first episodes, way back when, whenever that was.
Way back when.
Yeah, way back when, 2020, I think at this point. Mm-hmm. We discussed that because they have heard, you know, oh, I'm going to end up, living in a cardboard box. I mean, I have heard people say that, well, she's living in the Taj Mahal and I'm going to be living in a cardboard box. Well, obviously that doesn't happen. That is quite an exaggeration, but
that's certainly how it feels.
Of course.
Time, right.
Yes, so. Of course. And the biggest question people have is, am I going to be okay? That's the biggest, that's the scariest thing. I know when my ex-husband told me he wanted a divorce, those were my fears. Am I going to be able to stay in the house? What am I going to be able to do? Am I going to be okay? And those are the questions that most people have mm-hmm. when they're faced with a situation like this.
Very important questions. Very important questions. Yeah. So I think the episode that we did after that was dealing with income. Yeah. And it's important because alimony is based on income. And so the question, which is not that simple, is actually figuring out what is, how is income determined?
Right. I mean, you can't have a conversation about alimony unless you can agree on what income to use, because again, it's a formula and we base everything on the party's income. But if you can't agree on what the income is, then it becomes very difficult to make those calculations. Mm-hmm.
So for a lot of people, it's actually pretty simple right. because a lot of people just get W-2 income, meaning they're employees of some other organization. And so it's easy to determine what it is. They get a W-2 at the beginning of the year that says how much they made for the previous year. And there is no ambiguity there. Right. There can be some ambiguity as soon as we start talking about income that is not fixed, that is variable, such as bonus income or various other things that people get, such as commissions or income that is based, that is derived from executive compensation, such as restricted stock units and all of these things, right? So in general, what happens with alimony is that we come up at the base level, we come up with a fixed number. And therefore, we have to figure out what to do with the income that is variable, because obviously it's a problem.
Yeah. So Chris, is it my imagination or am I seeing more and more income with variable components?
It's not your imagination.
So like, you know, times are changing.
Yeah, I think it's along Route 128 and downtown in the seaport and stuff like that. People get a lot of executive comp. A lot of people have RSUs or stock options. Yep. And a lot of people get bonuses. It's common for companies to pay bonuses. And it's part of the landscape, right? Yes. And so basically what it leads us to is that it leads us to have a two-tiered alimony calculation, one that is based on the fixed income and one that is based on the variable income.
Right. And then that variable income, as we know, changes year to year. And so the agreements have to have some kind of mechanism in there so that they can do an annual true-up to understand, you know, so that they can adjust that payment on an annual basis, which can become very cumbersome.
It is very cumbersome because somehow, I don't know why, but people don't like to do that. Yeah, I know why, I'm being sarcastic, but It'd be useful if people were able to do something like that without having to revisit the entire issues that led to the divorce.
Right. But again, we do have ways of working around these types of issues when we have, variable income. Now, we're not talking in that particular episode, we were not talking about business income or, when someone has a family-owned business or they're self-employed. We were just talking about a W-2 that might have variable income on top of that, like you said, bonus commission and executive comp, which is the stock options and restricted stock units and things of that nature. I've also seen a lot of different types of those as well.
What? I'm sorry.
I've seen different types of stock options and
Oh,
things,
I see. Yes. Okay.
and different, like, they're called, oh gosh, PSUs. So it would be cash, where it's a cash award. So it's kind of like, from what something I've just seen recently, a bonus is paid, but 20% of the bonus is withheld and it vests in 3 years and is then paid out. So it's kind of a retention.
Right.
But I've seen other things like that that are units, they're shares, but it's cash.
Right. And
Vests.
then you also have things that are complicated, which is stock options equivalent or RSUs equivalent that are paid like cash, in cash, like you're mentioning, for private companies. The stock options and RSUs work for public companies because there is a market for the stock, and therefore you can always figure out what the value is. For private companies, it's harder because it's harder for them to issue stock. In fact, a lot of the time they can't. And but they come with equivalences, right? And so these come with their own complexities.
Right. Well, I'm seeing a lot of those too because of this environment of startups, right? And the startups inevitably are giving their employees stock options, very significant amounts of stock options, and with the hope and the intention that the company is going to go public. And
Yeah, and sometimes people divorce before that happens, right? So.
right. And so, but that other person knows that there is a potential value there. And so they want to capture that in the agreement.
In fact, it happens a lot. I mean, that's one of the complexities that people don't take into account a lot, right? Is that it happens in the cases of startups that become public companies that there is a significant amount of stock options that are sitting there that may or may not have been exercised. And then because of the divorce, you're forcing the exercise of them, right? And that creates a tax liability that is often pretty large. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes you're able through some planning to make the exercise of these options spread over time, and therefore reducing the tax liability. And so there's all kinds of little things that can be done in order to preserve wealth for a couple, and to have them, waste as little as is possible on that divorce.
No, it's very complicated.
Now, and people don't always realize that, right? Is that so sometimes people happen to have incentive stock options, right? So incentive stock options are different from RSUs in the sense that RSUs get taxed as ordinary income, meaning they get taxed like regular income. Whereas incentive stock options, if you exercise them and then hold them for a year, will get taxed as capital gains, which is a different rate and is usually lower, but not always, right? And there are some other complexities, such as alternative minimum tax and whatnot. And so that makes people want to hold that stock for a long time. And I don't know if you've seen what's happened in the stock market in the past 6 months. It hasn't been pretty, right?
No,
And so
but they can still hold on to it and wait.
they can, but then they can also do things that will reduce the risk of holding for a long time. Right. So I know of cases where the value of a chunk of options that have been exercised has decreased by about 50% since the beginning of the year, since February. And, you know, that's pretty painful.
Yeah.
Always have to remember that if it goes down 50%, in order for it to go back to its previous level, it has to go up 100%.
Right, right.
Right. So we were, I think these are stock options and stuff. And I think the other issues with respect to variable income was addressed in the following episode with Dave Consigli, who happened not to be a lawyer. And he's a CPA. And we're talking about figuring out what the income is for a business owner. Right. So business owners are some of our favorite people. Right, Diane?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Well, talk about adding
another. We're business owners.
Our business owners, our income is a little more straightforward than some of the other business owners out there. I mean, I believe both you and I report on a Schedule C, but we have lots of different other ways of looking at business income. And especially, you know, you and I are sole proprietors. So it's a little easier to ascertain our income. But we have other types of entities out there that become a little more complicated.
Sure. And I think the challenges there is that, for one thing, is that business income is variable, right? Is that it's not a straight salary. If you, you know, decide to take more time off this year, then you'll make less money,
right? Right?
But it is your privilege to decide that, and you don't have a boss that tells you that you can't.
Right.
The other thing that happens is the questions of expenses. Yeah. So as business owners have expenses, which makes sense, and sometimes the expenses, so the expenses will affect income, obviously, but sometimes not all of the expenses should affect income from the point of view of alimony calculations.
Right. I mean, how many times have you heard the spouse of a person who owns a business say to you, they're hiding money, they're doing something, they're running, they're paying for this through the business and that through the business. And, you know, like you hear this all the time, which is one reason why this business owner income becomes so contentious, and which is why that can drive up the price of a divorce if it's in litigation, because now you're hiring forensic people, forensic accountants and whatnot to go through everything and make sure that that person is reporting their income accurately and not doing things like running their own personal expenses through the business, which if you do that, the reason why we're interested in that type of scenario is because that's reducing that person's income, taxable income,
right,
and also reducing the availability for support.
I think the reality is that many business owners out there, I certainly don't want to say all, but many business owners out there have expenses that are at least questionable, mm-hmm. right? I mean, the standard one could be a cell phone. Mm-hmm. A cell phone is used for business, but it's also used for private purposes. And so it's sort of a hybrid. And then, you know, most business owners will take the default of less deducted as a business expense.
Right.
Sometimes it is things such as, well, last year, dinner. Last year, dinner was fully deductible as an expense. Business dinners were fully deductible as an expense. And sometimes what you do is that you take the family out and you deduct it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, it's a reality, but and sometimes you have things that are more standard. Depreciation. Right. So depreciation is a non-cash expense that helps to reduce taxable income. And because it is a non-cash expense, it really needs to be added back to the business owner's income because it benefits them directly in that
yeah.
way.
Yeah. Right? Well, one of the things that we have in our child support guidelines as well is an income definition, and they also address the income of self-employed people and business owners. That you know, what is the expense has to be for normal operating costs of a business. So, is this something that you have to do in order to run your business? And so, when you're looking at things, do we have to pay for our kids' to college tuition in order to run the business?
The answer is no, that's not a legal expense.
But yet we have seen that, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
Yeah. And also one thing that I saw, which kind of blew my mind a couple of years ago, was a business owner who was actually deducting the alimony he paid. And what he was doing was he was paying his ex-spouse on a 1099 and then reducing, using it as an expense in his business. Now, you can't do that.
Or you can't have your next love interest listed as an employee when he or she doesn't do any work.
Right. So, I mean, this is where the business owner creates a whole nother wrinkle in the and a whole nother knot that we try to untie.
I think we need to specify here that most businesses are businesses that are run ethically and legally.
Yes. Right?
It's just that some of the time we see things that are really quite outrageous.
Well, also, Chris, we know that for IRS purposes, you're allowed to do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't translate into what we do in divorce.
Right, exactly. Right. So like the depreciation is an excellent example, right? So sometimes you have other things that happen. Like, so I had the privilege of helping a business owner that was in a transportation intensive market, and so they had lots of vehicles on the balance sheet, and the vehicles also included their own personal vehicles. Mm. Right, and so the own personal vehicle is actually income that is essentially subsidized by the IRS, and so it needs to be removed.
Mm. Yep, well, that makes sense. So anyone who out there has self-employed income or is married to someone who is a business owner, you should definitely check out that episode. And that's episode 6.
Episode 6.
Yes.
So it's one of the more complicated things that happens out there in terms of determining income. It's sort of the other end of the spectrum from people who have straight W-2 income with no bonuses.
So after that, we actually had two very good episodes with the same guest appearance from Lisa Cookier, from an attorney from Burns and Levinson, which is located in Boston. And those were some really good topics. We talked about modifications and self-modifying agreements, which I touched on in the beginning when I talked about variable income and doing a true-up on an annual basis to recalculate alimony, maybe on a tier, when it's a tier, like a tier one and a tier two, we might have to recalculate tier two on an annual basis. So when that kind of mechanism is written into the separation agreement, we call that a self-modifying agreement.
Right.
And so that was a very interesting episode.
Yeah, I think self-modifying agreements are really useful in terms of avoiding the modifications, which is part of the episode, modification and self-modifying agreements. What happens once your divorce is sealed, signed, and delivered, it doesn't mean that is the end of it. You or your spouse get to potentially go back to court later on to ask for modification. And that means a change in the terms of the agreement, including the terms of alimony. The reason you want to do self-modifying agreements is because modifications can be tremendously expensive. Mm-hmm. In some cases, it's like doing your divorce all over again.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And we haven't talked, I think, in any of our episodes about the actual cause of divorce. So divorce doesn't have to be, how to say that, divorce is always expensive, but it doesn't have to be outrageously expensive, but it often is.
Yeah.
Right? So people have spent tens of thousands or sometimes hundreds of thousands getting divorced. And whatever it is that you're looking at, when you modify, when you go to court back for modification, it can cost about the same amount.
Right. So you really have to understand, is it worth it?
Is
you
it?
Know, is, That is the biggest question. What is what's my return
Right,
on
exactly.
doing this? But as we know, the child support is always modifiable, which means because people
that's an
are
interesting point.
Right, because people are always asking me, well, you know, wait a minute, what if, and I get this all the time, wait, what if I lose my job? I still have to pay that? You know, and the question is, no, you know, that is when you are able to go back and modify, because if you did lose a job, obviously you can't be expected to pay the same amount. So that is what, you know, modification is. The same for alimony. Alimony is also modifiable on most situations, except when the parties have agreed to not make it modifiable, which is when we use that term survive, alimony survives, or does alimony merge? And then the last thing that you typically cannot modify is what, Chris?
Asset division?
Correct.
Yes. I think the thing that the law is extremely flexible, right? And what these provisions do is that they try to make it, how to say that, more predictable, right? And so in the case of child support, the reason that it is always modifiable is because when a couple goes to court, they're usually represented by legal counsel, but the children are not. And so the court sees themselves as a protectors of the children's interests in that, not that it is a perfect system or what, but that's how it tends to work, right? So, and so alimony, when it survives, meaning the term that was used by Lisa is survival and merger, right? And an agreement that survives is something that is no longer modifiable by the court. And the asset division is one that survives also. And is it always like that? And the answer is that it's sort of ambiguous, because it's sort of like almost always like that. There are always cases that the law provides that you can go back and reopen an agreement. They're not very plentiful. It doesn't right. happen a lot, right?
No, it would have to be based on maybe fraud, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that happens when people divorce is that they have to do a financial statement. And that's not just your regular run-of-the-mill financial statement. It goes on a form that is provided by the court. And at the bottom of that form, they have to assign on penalty of perjury. Okay. People sometimes ignore that. And sometimes people will, you know, omit certain things that they should be putting in there. And they figure that once a divorce is done, it's all over. Not the case.
Right. No, it's sometimes people like it kind of a passive aggressive thing. They don't want to put everything down, but they don't understand that that can really come back and haunt them.
Right. I mean, the point is not about punishing the person who has an asset. The point is about trying to do a fair divorce, one that is fair to both parties to the extent that it is possible. Right. And that's why the disclosures are required.
Yeah, well, again, you always hear the horror stories as well. Like, those are the things that stick into people's minds, that someone's obviously hiding money, and then they have them in offshore accounts. And when you get right down to it, it's really difficult for just the regular person to have an offshore account.
it's hard. In fact, it's harder than ever. I mean, that's one of my pet areas of interest, is that it used to be a long time ago that some people had accounts offshore and they use them, right? But these days it's really hard, because everything has to be disclosed, right? And it has to be disclosed because of two laws. Again, one of them is FATCA. It's a 2010 law. It's a Financial Account Transaction Compliance Act. And the other one was a Patriot Act that happened right after 9/11. And by and large, what happens is that if you have a foreign asset, you have to disclose it to the Department of Treasury and to the IRS. And if you do not disclose it and they find out about it, you have some really punitive penalties. On the bank account, it can be 50%.
Wow.
Right. And so it's, it can be horrible, right? And so as a result of that, it's become a lot more difficult to for people to hide money overseas. Yeah. And if you think that your spouse has done that, you should probably pursue it, but think about it. It's not going to be a high likelihood item. It happens.
Yeah, it happens. It does. Right, it happens. Now, I also, this is something that maybe we need to cover in another episode at some point in the future, is cryptocurrency. Because, now there's a whole thing of people hiding assets in crypto.
I just got a certification in crypto actually this week.
Excellent. Well, then we will have to do that.
Maybe we'll have to talk about crypto and divorce or something like that.
When this all came out, I wasn't even thinking about it. And then when they started talking about crypto and divorce, I was like, oh no, now something else I need to not learn about. Right.
I think we were just talking about hiding assets. Potentially, crypto is one of those areas where there is still some possibilities of that. Mm-hmm. Right? And for a couple of different reasons, actually. For one is that older crypto accounts are pretty much anonymous.
Mm. Right.
Right. And newer crypto accounts is harder because the IRS has cracked down on them, cracked down on the various crypto exchanges, and the various crypto exchanges have to provide the same 1099s that your bank and your brokerage account provides. Yeah. Right. And so you will have a track. The older accounts can be sometimes harder, and certainly you can have, in fact, anonymous crypto accounts overseas.
Right.
So so it can be more difficult. But in general, most people are not hiding their tracks in a way that they cannot be found. So
right.
Some do, but you know.
So I think we're almost at our end here, coming up on the top of the hour.
We had our favorite topic, or at least one of my favorite topic, following that episode on self-modifying agreements, which was the topic of alimony buyouts.
Right. Yes. And I just had a case yesterday where that topic came up again. And I don't remember, was Lisa more favored towards the buyout or not?
I think she was in favor of buyouts, right? It's one of those things where, in general, we're told, Diane, that the courts don't like alimony buyouts. I really like it. I really like the idea. I mean, it's not that they come penalty-free in terms of you have to give up something in order to get a buyout. Let's start first with what is a buyout. A buyout is when the recipient of the alimony gets a lump sum payment instead of periodic payments over a period of time, and where the payor of the alimony makes that lump sum payment, right? I am in favor of them because one of the things that happens in divorce agreements is that you will have somewhere in the boilerplate a phrase that says, and the parties shall be able to live as if not married, right? They don't have to deal with one another anymore, et cetera, et cetera, right? But then we tell them they have to pay alimony. So what alimony buyout does is that it allows people to implement the spirit of that agreement, that the parties shall be able to go their own way.
Well, my concern is that the recipient who actually has a need, and that need doesn't go away with one lump sum payment. That, you know, the idea that there is a need is that it's on a monthly basis. It can be annual for years, because that alimony is meant to supplement whatever income they do have in order to pay those expenses. So what happens is, when you accept a buyout, you're foregoing those monthly payments in the future, and you're taking one lump sum of money that you are supposed to then invest to replicate.
Yeah. So those if monthly you do payments. Buyout, you better talk to someone like you or I, so that we can have a plan to make sure that if you receive a buyout, that you wouldn't run out of money over.
Right. Like my concern would be someone, you know, this is just human nature. Oh my gosh, I have $100,000. I'm going to go buy a new car. I'm going to go take that vacation. And all of a sudden now that lump sum that was meant to help support you for X number of years is now gone.
And unfortunately, if you're going to do an alimony buyout, it's one of those things that survives, meaning that you can't go back and go back and get another bite of the apple, so to speak. And you cannot get future modifications. You're going to give up future modifications, which can be good because you can't, you're giving up future modifications where the payments, your alimony payments might go down. But you also give up the future modifications where it might go up.
Right. So there's risk and reward. And I think we've mentioned this on many of our episodes that every decision you make in a divorce has a risk and a reward.
Right.
On which party you are.
Exactly. Exactly. The that being said, you know, it's true. People will do things with their money that maybe they shouldn't, right? Is that you mentioned vacation and cars? Is that some of the minor things coming around? The worst possible thing is that someone will decide to go invest it at Mohegan Sun at the casino.
Yeah, that would not be good because then they could lose all.
That would not be good. Yeah. And unfortunately, it has happened and the results are just not good.
Yeah. So our last episode was just last week and we were had Sandy Lundy with us and she has been an attorney for, she didn't want us to tell, but she's been an attorney for over 30 years.
Oh, come on. Don't let the cat out of the bag.
Well, because she, the reason why is because she has seen everything. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, she has a great wealth of knowledge when it comes to all aspects of divorce. And she enlightened us about, you know, the conversation that we've had many times about this interplay of alimony and child support. And it is really one of those, I think we'll never get a real answer on it. We just can only have a conversation about, you know, again, what works best for the family.
Right. I think the challenge, regardless of child support or alimony, is that we're talking about amounts of money. But the reality is, how is that money going to get spent, right? And what expenditures you're going to have to forego, regardless, right? Mm-hmm. Child support tends to be more based on formulas. It's more directive, if you will. And alimony is a lot more negotiable.
Yes.
And the end result is that the payors of alimony always complain that it is too much. And maybe it is compared to their expenses. And the recipients of alimony always complain that it isn't enough. Yeah. And it isn't compared to their expenses.
Right.
Well, so the whole point again is that expenses need to be reevaluated, right? And and a plan needs to happen to figure out how we're going to revalue those expenses and how we're going to make the money work and how the both parties will survive until the end of alimony and how they will thrive beyond it.
Well, I think it can go without saying that having to pay alimony and child support is really something that people don't really like to do afterwards, after the divorce, even for children, even for child support, even though you know this is meant to be support for your child. But a lot of times the payor will say, but you know, my spouse, my ex-spouse is using it for herself. Well, or himself. Well, that's, you know, not, you don't know that it's going to the family. It's meant to provide shelter, food and clothing for your child. And, you know, it should not be used as a weapon And, you know, to say, well, you know, you can't use it. That's only for the children, and I'm not going to pay it anymore.
It's really hard because, I mean, we're not talking about child support now because we did that before, but child support is supposed to pay for the basic expenses of the children. And that includes housing and so shelter and food. And if we're talking about shelter, well, yeah, the child's mom is also using that shelter. So yes, it is sort of fungible and it is used for food. And yes, it comes out of the same grocery bag, right?
So anyway.
I think we've covered a whole lot of things this the past season with these 9 episodes and this one, so the 10 episodes. I think it was fairly comprehensive, but obviously, like everything that we do here is only so deep because there's only so deep that we can go, even in the time that is allocated. And we need to remind people that if they are going through divorce or they are thinking of going through divorce, there is nothing that replaces a consultation with a qualified professional who will be able to use a person's individual circumstances and see how they can best work with it.
Right. Yep. Because it's not one size does not fit all in divorce.
It sure doesn't.
No, we have our guidelines, we have our laws, we have our case law, but there's always ways to deviate from them and to make things work what's best for the family, for right. You know, you and your family.
Right. And even in the, I think we've spent something like almost 10 hours doing this this series. Even in those 10 hours, we haven't covered everything.
No, not at all. Not at all.
So keep that in mind if you're watching, right, is that what we have talked to you about in the past 10 hours is just scratching the surface. Mm-hmm. Go talk to a professional.
Exactly. And join us in the fall for when we start again sometime in September.
Right. Diane, you and I need to have a conversation and figure out what we're going to do next fall, because this has been a great series and I don't know how we're going to top it.
I don't know.
So in the meantime, everyone out there, have a nice summer. You know, there's a lot of things to enjoy in life aside from having to worry about divorce issues.
Exactly. But when you do, just remember, TGIDF.
TGIDF. We'll talk to you later.
Bye.